Hello, Greg. This is Dennis Stevens here, and the date is the 3rd of November 1992, and I hope this tape finds you well. Although I will have acknowledged the receipt of your data by phoning you, I'd like to formally acknowledge the receipt of the letter from you. It arrived yesterday, as a matter of fact. And I'm glad that you were able to decipher my typing. I'm sorry I typed that material on both sides of the sheet of paper. It no doubt didn't help you. I was going through a period in late 1978 where my havingness was rather bad, and that's why I was typing on both sides of sheets of paper. I repaired my havingness sometimes after that. I don't do that these days. I write on one side of the piece of paper. But anyway, you managed to get it. You managed to get it duplicated, and no doubt you'll soon get it onto your the material onto your floppy disk. It's very good of you to put this material on the disk for me. Now, the main purpose of this tape, Greg, is to evaluate the unstacking procedure, which I promised I would do for you, and. But in order to do that, I've got to give you a fair bit of background data. So we shall press on with the background data. Then we'll go into the evaluation of the unstacking procedure. Thank you very much for sending it, by the way. As soon as I read the unstacking procedure, I recognised the leopard by his spots. In other words, I recognised the Hubbard technique. It's a direct offshoot of the Hubbard goals procedures of circa 1961 to 1964. I'd say around about the vintage of 1963 I would put that material, although he has modified it because there's things in there which I'm not familiar with, so there is modifications to the procedure. But nevertheless, essentially it's the material that Ron was working on in 1963, that he researched in 1963. Now, I was very fortunate that I happened to be at St. Hill in 1962, right in the middle of the material that Ron was working on, the subject of goals. Give you a little bit of background material here. He started work, as far as I know, well, I'm pretty certain about this because I heard the history of the material, history of his research in 1962. We had to hear it as a part of the briefing course. He started his research into goals in 1961, and by 1962 he was well into it. And I won't go into the various techniques that he produced, Ron, but to just to say that his original approach was to find a main goal on the pre-clear, and then try and find out what was opposing this goal, and then somehow get the goal erased. That was his general idea. His researches in Scientology up to this point had inevitably led him to the fact that the final up top level material in Scientology, the highest possible level of Scientology material, would be on the subject of purposes and postulates and goals. Anyone who researches in the field of the mind eventually ends up with this. One way or the other, they might get there in different routes, but they always end up there at that point. Ron ended up there in 1961. He'd started out in 1950 with engrams and incidents and charge and secondaries, and then he'd gone through various other procedures and so forth. But he finally, in 1961, he got to the end of the road, and he was facing the wall there. He had to get through this barrier of the postulates. By the way, I'm going to use the word postulate interchangeably with the word goal, and interchangeably with the word purpose, and interchangeably with the word intention. So postulate, goal, purpose, intention are synonyms. I'll explain this later on the tape, but just bear with me for the moment. I mention it because Mr. Nichols, in his unstacking procedure, he differentiates between these factors, but we'll talk about that later. When I got to St. Hill and started to get into the auditing material on goals, one thing that struck me was, I mean, I was in the presence of a number of the old-timers of Dianetics and Scientology. Some of them have been on the course for some longer time than me. They've been on the course for some months, and they've been fiddling around with these goals procedures. And I had to audit some of them, and some of them had to audit me. And I knew that these people were basically in pretty good case shape. For some of them I knew as people in the outside world, not just as fellow students on the course. But I was struck by the terrible state of their needles, the terrible state of their meter responses. Almost invariably they had, the whole course at that time, with very few exceptions, had a high tone arm and stuck needles. I was one of the few exceptions. Probably 10% of the course were exceptions. And it wasn't until much later that I realised that why I was an exception, and probably the reasons why some of the others were exceptions. But anyway, that was one of the first things that struck me about this research, was that what it was doing to these people's tone arms. In fact, the old Mark IV meter was, one of the reasons why Rod developed the Mark V meter was during this period that the sensitivity of the Mark IV was insufficient to read through these high tone arms and stuck needles. He needed a more sensitive instrument, so he developed the Mark V. It was also quite apparent that the people on the goals procedures were not getting anywhere case-wise. They were, although they were all hopeful, everyone was all hopeful that we'd eventually get something out of it, the general tendency was that the people were worse off case-wise than they had been when they started the course. That was the general, although it wasn't mentioned, that was the general sort of impression that there was. I knew many of these people before they'd come on the course, and they were in far better case shape prior to going on the course than they were on the course. So obviously it was hitting them hard. And these people had a whack of auditing, you know. I mean, many of them turned out, the vast majority were clears and low-level OTs and had been for many years, me included. So anyway, that's the subjective, a little subjective look at what was going on at St. Hill. Ron started off, as I say, with finding goals, and then he got into this subject of end words. That came later, in about 1963. Then he got into the subject of the implant GPMs, which eventually became parts of the clearing procedure. He abandoned the idea of finding goals on the pre-clear. He simply wrote them down, whole lists of them, and swore that they're all parts of implants, and swore that that this was what you had to do, and left it at that. In fact, he sort of despaired. I think he secretly knew that he'd failed in that area of research. He patched it up as best he could and did the best job he could on it. And but I know I left St. Hill in not very good case shape. And over the years afterwards, I met many of the casualties of that period of auditing at St. Hill. Every so often in Sydney, some ex-St. Hiller who'd been there doing goals in 1962 to 1964 would sort of wander into Sydney and look me up, we'd have a little session or something, and I'd have him on the meter, and I'd say, oh my God, this whole area was a major engram on his case. Some people did really suffer. One girl in Sydney I know, that I don't think she's recovered yet. Unfortunately, we hadn't got the procedures to repair the situation. I had no real repair for it. Nobody had a real repair for it. We didn't even know what was going on. All we knew was that if you weren't careful when you mucked around with goals, that you ended up with a high tone arm, a stuck needle, and the pre-clear was getting a lot of sin, and he usually had a black field. He'd lose his pictures, his field would go black, and he'd feel as if he was getting a lot of breeze blowing, what they used to call the winds of space. He used to feel as if there was a light breeze blowing on his face all the time. This, of course, was just energy impacted around his face, energy deposits, which was affecting the skin. And they were in pretty bad shape. And the people who went on the course in good case shape survived it, but those who went on the course, there was a minority that went on that briefing course in 1961-62, were in rather bad case shape when they went on course, and it really hit them hard, this material did. Many of them, they simply their case-wise, they've been in a mess ever since. I don't know whether they've ever got out of it to this day, because there was no repair for it in Scientology. There was no repair to what happened to these people in Scientology. It was only in my own research, many years later, I discovered what had happened to these people and got the repair out for it. I know the repair, but I don't think it's generally known outside of my research exactly how to take this situation apart. But the truth of the matter is that what I'm leading up to is this datum, that when you muck around with goals and purposes, you're okay. You can ask the pre-clear for goals and purposes and postulates, as long as you don't ask him to oppose them. Get that very clearly. You're quite safe. Any auditor can work with goals and purposes and intentions, as long as he doesn't ask what is the who or what would oppose that goal. What would be the opposition goal to that goal? Now, once you ask that question, you walk where angels fear to tread. There was the danger point. There was the line that Ron crossed, and it all went wrong from that point onwards. I didn't know why it went wrong. None of us knew why it went wrong. None of us had to repair to put it back right. There was just endless repairs. Even the repairs were being repaired. And the repairs that were repairing the repairs were being repaired. It just all fell apart at that point. In fact, I would go so far as to say that this was one of the main causes of the decline of Scientology. Ron Hubbard, case-wise, took an enormous pounding on this. It hit Ron very hard indeed, case-wise, subjectively himself. He looked absolutely terrible in 1962 when I was over there. I knew he was under enormous re-stimulation. You could see it. He was bravely struggling on with his research. The research was killing him. And he was trying everything he knew to get this subject of goals out right. And he never did get it right. And case-wise, he never did recover. He went downhill case-wise. It hit Ron as hard as it hit anyone. Case-wise, he went downhill badly from 1964 onwards. Even though he abandoned work on goals, went on to other things. Still, he couldn't lift that material. He couldn't lift that re-stimulation. And the datum here is that See, you're safe, you can work with goals and purposes. It's quite safe as long as you don't ask that key question, what would oppose it. You can do anything else with a goal or a purpose. You can put the goal, you can mock them up, you can have other people mock them up. You can ask, what purpose would a thing have? What's the purpose of a cat? What's the purpose of a dog? What's the purpose of a brick? What's the purpose of a house? You know, what purposes have you had? You can list goals. You can get me to write long lists of goals. I mean, the audience has got enormous freedom on the subject. But he must not, having got a purpose or a goal, he must not ask what is the opposition goal unless he knows exactly what he's doing. If he doesn't know exactly what he's doing, doesn't know the complete anatomy of the subject of goals and purposes in the mind, he'll rapidly worsen his pre-clear, and he won't know what's going on, and he won't be able to repair it. The effect is that if you muck around with goals and the opposition to goals and ask that question, who or what would oppose a goal, and you don't know if the complete anatomy of what's going on, your attempt to use this technology, the attempt to run these processes and so forth, will act as a major, sit on the pre-clear case as a major engram. And this is what happened to the Scientologists on the briefing course. The auditing was an engram. If you ever get one of these people that were at the St. Hill briefing course between 1961 and 1964, the whole of that period when they worked on goals, you will find the whole of that area will sit on their case like an engram. It will respond exactly like an engram. As you come up to it, the needle will start to jiggle. As you get closer to it, the needle will go into rises. And then as he starts to talk about the breathing course, you'll see the needle rise. And you see the tone rise. It's just as if the pre-clear is approaching a major engramic experience which he cannot confront. This is what one of the things that I spotted myself later after I left the briefing course. I got to work with some of these people trying to repair. And every one of them, without exception, who've been at the briefing course, as soon as you tried to talk to them about it, or many of them wanted to talk to you about it because they were so upset about it, as soon as they started to talk about the briefing course, 1961 to 1964, and the auditing they'd had, up would go their tone arm and the needle would stick. And it was just as if you were talking about a major engram on their case. So that's the first moral of the story there. It's a rather grim message. It's rather grim, Greg, that you're limited. There is a limitation on the subject of working with goals and purposes. You don't ask that question, who or what would oppose a goal or a purpose, unless you know exactly what you're doing. And that, unfortunately, does mean a familiarity with my research. You know, I, as far as I know, I don't know if anyone's ever got a complete repair for this except myself. I have a complete repair for it. Okay, so far so good. Now let's press on with our background material. The real reason why the upper level tech in Scientology, or the upper level tech in the mind, devolved around this subject of postulates, is this stems from this datum that the universe in which we live only consists of light and postulates. The universe in which we live only consists of life and postulates. And you can call postulates, we mean purposes, intentions, goals. They're synonyms as far as I'm concerned. So the universe in which we live only consists of life and postulates. But once you understand that, you see that how fundamental the subject of postulates is, and that why one has to get it right before one gets involved with it. You don't get any second chances on it. Once you start to oppose postulates, you don't get any second chance. I mean, what I'm trying to say here is that you've got a fair amount of latitude when you're working with objective processes, say getting the pre-clear to go around and touch objects. You can do a pretty botched up job of auditing, still the pre-clear will get a bit of a case gain. When you're dealing with masses in the mind, pictures and so forth, you can do a pretty botched up sort of auditing job, and the pre-clear will still get some gain out of it, unless he's in rather bad case shape. But you'll get some gain out of it. Just the fact that he's moving up and down his track and looking at a few pictures, he'll get a bit of case gain. This was the old 10% that Ron used to talk about. You know, 10% of cases will get better no matter what you do. And this was the 10%. But when you get onto postulates, you lose that. You're okay, as I say, as long as you don't ask that question, who or what will oppose. You can do what you like with postulates as long as you don't ask that question. They still make good case gains on a pre-clear. But if you ask that question, you've got no latitude. You do it right, or you kill the pre-clear. Eventually you'll kill him. You've got to do it right. It's too close to the top of what life consists of, what this universe consists of. Postulates is the building blocks of the very building blocks upon which the universe is composed. So you better get it right. Otherwise, it all falls apart. Now, my entry into the subject of goals came in 1978 when I started to do my own research. First of all, I researched and got out my lower levels, levels 1, 2, 3 and 4. Then I had nowhere else to go in my research except into postulates. And I sweaty blood over postulates, just like Ron Hubbard did in my own research. But fortunately, I had the benefit of hindsight. I knew what had happened in 1962 in this briefing course. I was there. I knew what had happened. And I'd seen what had happened to the pre-clears. So I knew there was something odd about this, and so I avoided the pitfalls. In other words, I started afresh. I didn't take Ron's research as gospel. You see, Ron went into his research in 1961, the subject of goals and the subject of oppositions on goals, he made an assumption, and the assumption was an incorrect assumption, and it because he that this assumption was incorrect that all his later troubles on the subject of goals and postulates and so forth fell around his ears. It's an assumption that almost any Scientologist would make, would get it wrong. And the assumption was wrong. Ron got it wrong. He assumed that the pre-clear, if a pre-clear's got a goal or a purpose there and he expresses it to the auditor, that if the auditor asks him who or what would oppose that goal or purpose, that the bricklayer is in a position to give him the correct opposition as far as the bricklayer is concerned. You see, it's a natural thing to do. You say, well, it's a bricklayer's goal, so he would know what opposes it, you see, quite naturally. It's a bricklayer's business. It's his mind. He knows what opposes what in his mind. Yes, but they're wrong opposes. This is the joker in the pack. If the bricklayer knew what opposed what in his mind, he wouldn't have the mind. What he believes is the opposition goal is wrong opposed. That's why it's in his mind. It's a lie. It's an incorrect opposition. That's why it's stuck there. It's a lie. If it was the correct opposition, it would vanish by inspection. It wouldn't be nothing engrammed about it. It wouldn't be sitting there as a mass in his mind. You see, the engram bank consists essentially of lies. Do you see that? So if it's sitting there, there must be a lie in it. Ron has said this many times. There's got to be a lie in it, he'd say, otherwise he wouldn't be there. If it was the truth, it would unmock. Ron Hubbard knew that. We've known that in Scientology for many years. If it was the truth, it would unmock. In fact, there's an axiom which says so. So when the order says to the bricklayer, who or what would oppose this goal, the bricklayer says, oh, so-and-so and so-and-so. Now, it doesn't matter how this bricklayer tells you this. He might give a flash answer, or the auditor might give him a sheet of paper, says, right, write down all the oppositions and we'll meet or check them. Doesn't matter how you do it, you'll end up with the wrong oppose. You can't get the right one, because the right one isn't in there. See it? You can't win. It was a no-win situation from the word go that's on Ron's research. As soon as he asked that question, who or what would oppose, he was doomed to failure. Because the right answers was not in the pre-clear's engram bank. The only thing that was in the engram bank was the lies, and that's why they were in the engram bank. You see it? There's a little bit of logic there. He had to get past. And it wasn't until 1978 that I spotted the flaw. So I said to myself in 1978, well, if everything the pre-clear offers up on the subject of oppositions is a wrong oppose, how the hell do you find the right oppose? What is the correct opposition? Well, it's a logical construct. You have to construct the correct opposition logically by what is reason in the universe. In other words, the opposition to the correct opposition to a goal is not a matter of opinion. The opposition to a goal, the correct opposition, is not a matter of opinion. It's fixed by the nature of this universe. And everything else is false. It's either the correct opposition or it's a wrong oppose. It can't be partially correct. It's either exactly right or it's a wrong oppose. And if it's a wrong oppose, it will kill the pre-clear. It will just add to his bank because it's another lie. You see, Greg, there's only two types of lies in this universe. You can say that a thing exists when it doesn't exist, or you can say that a thing doesn't exist when it does exist. Or another way to put it, you can say that a thing is true when it's false, or you can say a thing is false when it's true. Now, when you say the pre-clear says this, when he gives you a wrong oppose, he's saying that the thing that exists is what he thinks it's true, but it's false. See that? He's giving you with the best will in the world. He says, yes, I believe this opposes. This is the correct opposition. But it's the false opposition. It's false because he got it out of his bank. It has to be, you see. So it's a lie. He's saying something is true, which happens to be false, even though he believes it. He believes the lie, but it's still false because he got it out of his bank. So I had to sit down and logically say to myself, okay, well, what would oppose a goal? And started to construct the goals packages. And I found, as you, when you read through my research, you'll see the construct there, that there's four goals in a goals package. Every goals package has four. There's the goal, there's negative, it's opposition goal, and the negative opposition goal. But there is the four goals in the package. There's only four in the package. There's only four in every package. Never less than four, never more than four. There can't be. The universe says so. Let's take the goal to know. Now you can take this try this test on almost anyone. You take, you say it can come up with a person, particularly somebody in good case shape. Don't try it on people in rather bad case shape, because you wouldn't expect them to give you the right answers. But I've done this with good, you know, I remember one guy came through Sydney. He just came back from the briefing course or somewhere, or from the Sea Org, and he was so clear that you could almost see the Harbour Bridge through him. And I got to speaking to him, and I asked him, I thought, well, I'll just check out, see how he is on the subject of goals. I'd already started my research. I asked him, I said, what would be the opposition goal to the goal to know? What would oppose the goal to know? And he looked at me, he said, well, he said, the goal to not know. And I immediately knew that he knew nothing about goals. You know, he just hadn't got it. The goal to not know does not oppose the goal to know. The goal to not know is the negative of the goal to know. It's not the opposition. You see, this is why it works. You start with a scale here on the subject of the goal to know. Right at the top of the scale, you have a very, very intense goal to know. Then the goal gets less intense, less intense, less intense, until you reach a zero point where there's no intensity of the goal to know. So there's no goal there at all. As it loses its intensity, the goal itself vanishes. So you get a zero point where there's no goal. Then you go over the zero point, and now you're into the negative goal to not know. You get a very tiny goal to not know. And as you intensify that goal, you get more and more intensity of the goal to not know, until you reach maximum intensity of not know. But there's the scale. It goes from plus maximum intensity goal to know, which is must know, big must know, go down to zero point where there's no goal at all. Then it goes minus maximum on the other side is mustn't know. Maximum mustn't know. See that? But must know doesn't oppose mustn't know. This one is simply the negative of the other. They're not in opposition. This is the logical construct, you see. So I think to myself, well, what is the goal to know? What is it actually in opposition to? Well, the goal to know is opposed to the goal to not be known. I mean, if you're trying to know something, the purpose that frustrates you most, and exactly frustrates you, is the purpose not to be known. You see that? If you think about it, it's obvious. That is the exact opposite goal. You're trying to know, and there's somebody over there trying not to be known. You're saying, must know, and he's saying, mustn't be known. Exactly. Exact opposition. So on the other side of the fence, we have, one side of the fence, we have must know. On the other side of the fence, we have mustn't be known. And the negative of mustn't be known, of course, is must be known. And, lo and behold, what do we find? We find that must know and mustn't be known are exact opposite goals. But, because of that scale I mentioned, where they go from plus to minus, the goal, mustn't know, is the exact opposite of the goal, must be known. Get it? There's the four postulates. There's plus, there's the net plus, there's positive to know, negative to not know. Positive to be known, negative to not be known. And to be known is opposed by to not know. And to know is opposed by to not be known. There's four postulates in the package. There's nothing else in the package. When you think about it, that's the complete package. There's only those four. And that is the whole subject of knowing, is in that package. There is the whole subject there. Anything else is a wrong oppose. Any other opposition to the goal, any other opposition to the goal to know except the goal to not be known is a wrong oppose. It has to be. Now, the strange thing is that you could use a listening technique on a pre-clear. You could sit any pre-clear down and say, all right, let's take the goal to know. You say, all right, now, who or what would oppose the goal to know? What's some opposition goals here? What would oppose, not who or what, say what would oppose the goal to know? What would be the opposition to the goal to know? Write them down. Give him the list and he writes them down. He writes you a list 20,000 long. He's got everything on his list. You go on over the list and ask him what he thinks about the list, what he thinks. He gives you some ideas, and whether you null the list or whatever you do with the list. He finally gets up with one. He says, that is the one. And it's the wrong one. And worse still, you go over the whole list, and nowhere on the list do you find to not be known. It isn't even on the bloody list. Why isn't it on the list? Because it's not in his bank. See, he's ransacking his bank looking for the answer, and the answer isn't in there. So he can't put the correct answer on his list, because it's not in there, you see. The correct answer is a logical construct. To give you the correct answer, you'd have to think about it analytically. You'd have to say, well, what would be the exact opposition to the goal to know? You'd have to figure it out, work it out logically, in terms of pure reason. Then he could give it to you. But you never list it out. You see that? Okay, so you take the goals, you formulate the goals package on a logical construct. You take these goals to know, with its opposition to not be known, and the goal to not know, with its opposition to not be to be known, and you work with those, then the magic occurs. All wrong opposes blow. All wrong opposes blow. You've worked with those four postulates, and all the wrong oppositions on the subject of knowing that he's got in his whole mind would eventually blow, because you're working for the truth, you see. The four is the truth. But the truth of the matter is that to know exactly complements to be known. They're exactly complementary. There's absolutely no opposition between those two goals. They exactly complement each other. Left to themselves, they would close the distance and collapse in on each other unless you held them apart. They're complementary postulates to know and to be known. Similarly, to not know and to not be known are complementary postulates. Again, left to themselves, they will collapse in on each other. And they cancel each other out. Literally, they cancel each other out. If you have somebody walking around with a great desire to be known, you know the sort of person who's all the time going around wanting people to look at him all the time, creating big effects. Well, if you sit around and look at him and know him and watch him and so forth, everyone sits around and admires him and looks at him and watches him, you'll eventually wear out his postulate to be known, because you're complimenting it exactly, and eventually it will fade out. He simply would not be able to hold the postulate against that complimentary postulate. Do you see that? So the two, a complimentary postulates vanish each other. The opposition postulates stay there forever. So there's the pure magic. If you wanted to address the subject of knowingness and get the whole subject, all the wrong opposes, all the wrong mishmash of upsets in his bank, you wanted to clear the whole lot out on the subject of knowingness, you would address in therapy the four postulates: to know, to not know, to be known, and to not be known. They are the whole subject anyway, you see. You would address those. And you imagine, all while you work with those, all the rest would start to come apart. The whole tangled web of wrong opposes would unravel, and you would be left with nothing. You simply erase them. You simply erase the bank. That's the erasure. That's the magic that occurs there when you work with the exact goals package. All the wrong opposes come apart. You're left with nothing. Just the four postulates. And they themselves, because the four postulates, the two complementaries banish each other anyway, you end up with a handful of nothing. You see? And you've got the perfect erasure of the bank. Now, this was the repair I didn't have for the victims of the St. Hill briefing course experience of 1961 and 1964. I didn't have this repair until 1978, 78, 79, that I had the full repair there. And it's the only repair I know of that if you wanted to take this whole subject of their miserable life, the upsets they had, the fact that these upsets are still going down the track, and the whole of their briefing course experience was sitting there like a major engram, the correct thing to do would be level 5-0 of my procedure. That would take it apart cleanly. It did it for me. I can look over my briefing course experience now, and the e-meter yawns at me. There's absolutely nothing there. It's absolutely clean. There's nothing there at all. There's no charge on that at all. It's gone. I've meter checked it, so forth. Gone. Been gone for years. But it wasn't in 1975. I had a hell of a lot, like all the rest of the people who've been on that course, I had a hell of a lot of charge on that material. It was sitting on my case like a major engram too. And I was in pretty darn good case shape. God knows what it was doing to people who were in rather worse case shape than I was in. Okay, so much for that, Greg. We now press on. And I said earlier on that the mass, that we live in a universe that only consists of life and postulates. Well, where does all the mass come from? I mean, it's not mocked up mass in the universe. How come there's so much mass in the universe? It's not been created mass. It's not directly created mass. It just doesn't work out that way. It's not created mass. If it was created mass, it would come apart rather easily. But no, it's not created mass, the mass of this universe. If you've ever tried to erase a sideboard in a room in present time, you'll know what I'm getting at. That this stuff does not come apart very easily. And it's not mocked up mass. If it was simply mocked up mass, you'd only have to get the idea it was somebody else's mock up, and it would start to thin down. And a gang of you could sit around and start to erase sideboards very easily using the upper level tech of Scientology. Any good grade, low level OT in Scientology, a gang of them could sit together and could spend their Sunday afternoons unmocking sideboards and unmocking bits of walls and floors, you know, if they wanted to. They could do it, but it doesn't work out that way. You can't take this stuff apart. Now, why doesn't it come apart easily? Well, it isn't mocked up mass, that's why it doesn't come apart. So if it's not mocked up mass, then what the hell does it consist of? Well, I'll tell you what it consists of. It consists of postulates. But how the hell can a postulate look like a mass? Well, it depends which way you look at it. I see I'm getting towards the end of this tape, and I think I'll just drone on a little bit on this side, a bit more, and then go and turn over to the other side of the other side of the tape. I have to keep my eye on the tape, otherwise I run off the end of the spool. Now, is there any other way that mass could come apart? We've got a universe, you see, that consists of life and postulates, and that's all it consists of fundamentally. Well, is there any other way that mass could get into this universe except by mocking it up? That's really the problem you're faced with. You've got a universe that only consists of life and postulates, and mass starts to turn up in the universe. Well, it either gets there because it's directly mocked up, directly created by life, or it comes through some other method. Well, there is another method that it gets into the universe. This is the unknown method. This is the one that's the secret method. And this is the where 999.99% or 999.99 parts out of 1,000th of the mass in the universe comes from. The rest of it is somebody else's mock-up, or people's mock-ups. But we'll turn over the other side of the spool, and we'll get onto the subject of how it comes about. But let me briefly talk a little about the subject of the sensations. Now, we've known in Scientology for a long while that sensations are a sort of mass. A sensation is not an emotion. Sensations are not emotions. They're different from emotions. Emotions are little masses too, but sensations are somewhat different. And it wasn't understood where these sensations come from in Scientology, but we sure as hell knew that they existed because everyone's got them. But nobody seemed to quite understand just how they came about and what they were. Well, one of the things that I discovered when working on the subject of postulates in opposition was that sensation occurs at the boundary between opposing postulates. Sensation is generated, to be more precise, sensation is generated at the boundary of opposing postulates. So now we'll finish this side and go on the other side of the tape. Just run the tape off the end of the spool, Greg, and I'll get back with you on the other side. Right, here we are, Greg, back on side two, same date, afternoon, side two. Now we have this datum that sensation is generated at the boundary between opposing postulates. Now this is an important datum, because this gives you this is the essence of where the vast, vast majority of mass in this universe comes from. You see, there's a scale of sensations which goes from very, very light sensations down through very, very heavy sensations. As the space closes and the intensity of the postulates increases, the quality of the sensation intensifies. And, the quality of the sensation changes and is perceived as rather as mass rather than as a sensation. Although actually it's I don't want to get too involved in this, Greg, because it gets into material where I'm still researching. But I can say at this point with absolute certainty that the vast majority of this universe, the mass in this universe, comes about at the boundary between opposing postulates and is essentially sensation mass. It's sensation, it's mass that's brought about in games play where there's conflict between opposing postulates. And the mass tends to condense out. There's various mechanisms of condensation. But essentially, if you were to take the mass and examine the mass, you would see it's scrunched up postulates. When they're jammed in, pushed in hard together, where you get a postulate scrunched up hard against its opposition postulate, and you find all, supposing you had two goals package, you had a goals package, and you had the two opposing postulates of a goals package where they're in opposition. Well, at the boundary, you would find both postulates there, scrunched up. And that would be the sensation, that scrunched up postulate where the two are jammed together. You would find that would be the sensation, because the mind can't easily, or the person, the life cannot easily duplicate or perceive that scrunched up postulate. It sees it as mass. That's why you see the sensation as mass rather than perceiving it as a sensation. That is the essence of it. But as I say, my own research isn't complete on that. But I'm absolutely certain that is the mechanism. That's how the mass in the universe comes about. It comes about through conflict in games play. It's a generated mass. It's not a It's not a created mess, it's a generated mess, and it consists of fosh that's scrunched up. In actual fact, you would find the mass generated in any gold package. There's four postlets in the gold package. The mass generated between any two opposing postlets in the gold package would actually consist of a scrunched up mass of all four postlets in the package. You always find all four postlets present in the mass. I do know that. I know the postlet configuration there, but there's certain aspects of it that I'm not completely satisfied with, so I won't go into it, because I don't like to go off half-cocked in these matters. But so far, that what I've given you so far, you can take it as the way it is. It seems a bit peculiar at first glance that you can see perceived sensation as mass, but I can assure you it's a postulate configuration. If the configuration is right, then you look at it and you don't see it as a postulate configuration. You simply see it as a mass. It's a sort of confusion. You see it as a confusion, if you like. You say, well, the postulate is so scrunched up and it's so confused, I can't see it as a series of postulates. They're all scrunched up in there and tangled up in a mass. So I see it as a mass rather than as a series of postulates. And that's the essence of it. But the important datum here is the mass only consists of postulates. Now, you can prove this, that a mass only consists of postulates. So you can actually prove it in auditing. It's a technique I developed a couple of years or so ago, long after I needed the technique. But you can take a mass or any terminal there, and you could say, suppose you take a dog. I know a dog's an animate creature, but it works just as well on a dog, or it would work on an inanimate object. Don't have to prick this upset with a dog. You could erase the dog from his mind by asking him, what is the purpose or function, if you like. Usually when it's a living creature, you say purpose. If it's an inanimate object, you would say function. You say, what is the purpose of a dog? What's its goal? What's its purpose? And the preclear tells you. You take up, you grab him on the meter, and you take up each one of the purposes of the dog. Preclear says, oh, the dog's bark. You say, well, how do you feel about that? Oh, he said, I had this terrible thing. We used to live next door to a dog that barked all the time. It drove me mad. You know, and you take this up, you run this material, you see. And so he was all right about that purpose. Then you say, is there any other purpose that a dog has? And he says, well, it's they bite people. Oh, well, how do you feel about it? Oh, I got bitten by a dog once, he says. And so you run that material out, you see. So see what you're doing here. You're discharging the dog's purposes, his opposition to it. But you're not mentioning the word oppose, you see. You're very smart. You're not mentioning the word oppose. You're saying, what's the dog's purposes? Eventually you go through all these purposes and get them all squared around. And he feels all right about the dog's purposes. He feels better about the dog's purposes. Then you say to him, well, what purposes have you had or got towards the dog? Then you take up this side of the coin. Oh, well, I've always had this urge to kick a dog, you know. Oh, well, how do you feel about that? And you find some instances where he's kicked dogs, and he's secretly kicked dogs, and he's done all this and that and the other, you see. And you go along this until you've got all his purposes out regarding the dog. Then you go back to the dog. So what are the purposes for dogs? Is there any more material showed up? Is you keep going backwards and forwards on his purposes towards the dog and the dog's purposes towards him. Lo and behold, magic, the dog would vanish out of his mind. Because you erased all the purposes, you see. He now got all the purposes there, and he's got them sort of squared around. And you haven't mentioned the gold package. But the technique is powerful enough to erase the dog out of his mind just there. And it proves that all that is present there is the purposes. You could do it with a house brick. You know, you could erase a house brick. If a person's got house bricks in his engram bank, you could say, well, what's the function of a house brick? And he'd tell you. And you run that and square that all around, and then get some more functions of a house brick, then get his purposes towards the house brick. Which then you do this backwards and forwards until there's no more charge on it. And at that point, you find the house brick that erased from his mind, you see. Because there's nothing else there. The house brick is essentially a purpose, you see. There's nothing else there but the purpose. You follow? But there's a little technique there, and it proves that there's nothing else, that the mass essentially is a mass of purposes, and there's nothing else there but purposes. There's other ways to erase things from the mind, but that is one way to do it, without getting too involved in goals packages. It takes longer. There's quicker ways to do it by using the goals packages, as you know in my procedure. But that will do it. It takes longer, but it will get there in the end. And it proves that all that is involved is the purposes. There's nothing else involved. A dog is a living creature running on a set of purposes. And a house brick only consists of purposes. And so on. You see, we live in a universe that only consists of life and purposes. That's all there is. The rest is illusion. One other point I want to get into before I go on to an evaluation of the unstacking procedure. I mentioned earlier, and you'll find in my research that I sent you, the idea that the to know goals package is the basic goals package. And since I wrote that material out, I can actually prove that this is there. I didn't have the proof at the time when I wrote those notes up, but I'm in a position now to give you the proof that the to know goals package is the basic of all goals packages. And it comes about, the proof is very simple proof. To understand it, we have to understand the subject of importance. Importance. Now, an importance of a goal is the enforcement of a goal. It's the mustness of a goal. When a goal is trivial, the purpose is trivial, it has very little intensity. But as the goal becomes more important to us, and we strive to achieve this goal in life, we increase its intensity, and the goal now is a must. In other words, take the goal to know, it starts off just as light, you know, we really don't care whether we know or not. Then we must know, you see, it must. Well, the must is the enforcement of the goal. See that? Now, any goal can have an enforcement, must. We could put the mustness of any goal. We have the goal to help. We must help. It can either be a light, you see, not much enforcement, or it can be a heavy must help, you see, heavy enforcement of the goal. So any goal can have an enforcement or mustness, 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 an awful word. It simply means enforcement of the goal. But look, the enforcement of a goal, when we're enforcing a goal, we're saying that the goal, the only reason why we enforce it is to try and convince the opponent of our purpose. We're having trouble getting our message across to him, you see. So we increase the intensity of the purpose, the mustness of the purpose, in order to get it through to the opponent. In other words, we're trying to win the game, you see. So we increase the intensity for that reason. So it's a conviction phenomenon. The mustness is a conviction phenomenon, and we're trying to make it known to the opponent. Now, you get it. The mustness, the enforcement of the goal, is the only reason we increase the mustness of the goal is to make it known to the opponent. But to be known is the basic goals package. Now, the enforcement of any goal is its know component. It's got a must be known component of the goal. So must be known is a part and parcel of any goal in life. It's the enforcement part. And more than that, as we take the enforcement out of the goal, as I mentioned earlier, as the enforcement comes out, there's eventually, when all the enforcement has gone from the goal, there's no goal left. You see, if you must know, you've got the goal there, a heavy must know. But as you take the mustness, the enforcement out of the goal, it becomes more and more trivial, more and more trivial, more and more trivial, until there's no mustness in it at all. Well, at that point, the goal's gone. You can't have a goal without some intensity in it to achieve. You see that? Without any intensity at all, you're down to zero. You reach the zero point on the scale. So without the mustness, there's no goal. Just like you've got a cat. Well, you take all the catishness out of the cat, and you end up with nothing. You can't have a cat without any catishness, you see. It's the same with a goal. You can't have a goal without some mustness in it. got to have some nastiness in it, just like the cat has to have some cattishness, otherwise you lose all the cat, so you lose all the goal, you take all the enforcement out of it. But the enforcement component is the be known, must be known component. See that? It's driving it across to the opponent, trying to get the goal across in games play. So that, and that's that determines the existence of the goal. We find that the basic package, the must be known package, that package containing the must be known, which is the to know goals package, is the basic goals package. And all the other goals packages are really within that package. It's the proof. That is the proof of the fact, which comes out in practice. It works out in practice that the basic package is the basic package. And it will do all those magical things. You can play around with junior packages and get into an awful mess, and you run the basic packages, and it all comes back right again. And why you have to do level 5A before you play around with any other packages? You must do 5A. You've got to get that one straight. And when that one's erased, the whole bank's erased. The whole lot's gone. That is the basic package. The only reason a person has to run anything else but level 5A is because they don't believe that the to know goals package is basic. They believe there's other things in their mind except knowingness, and there isn't. There's nothing else in there except the four legs of the to know goals package. That's all that's in there. All the rest is just illusion. So much for that, Greg. Now we can go into the evaluation of this unstacking procedure. Now, before we get into it, you might reasonably ask, how can I evaluate this procedure without having run it on me or run it on anyone else? Well, I can answer that very, very easily. It doesn't need running on me, because I try to run it and it's all flat. It's all flat because the subject of goals, purposes with me, knowing the basic packages and knowing the basic theory of it, there's just simply nothing there. I just read through the material yesterday, and there's a little bit of charge on reading on the wrong opposes when I was in those awful wrong opposes in the examples he gives. They were a bit scrunchy, and I had to sort of yawn those off. They were a bit awful, they were. But apart from that, there was nothing there. So the material doesn't need running on me, because there's simply nothing to run. So that answers your question. And if I wanted to run it on someone else, well, I simply wouldn't, because I know that it's of the flaws he's got in the procedure, and that I'm sure Mr. Nichols himself would realise his flaws once he got his paws on my data. If he had his paws on my data, he realised the flaws, just as Ron would have realised the flaws. I wasn't able to give my research to Ron Hubbard. It was just too late. I never could get it to him. I knew if I posted it off to him that he would never get to him. And I didn't know where he was in 1979. I didn't know whether he was still at sea, or I knew his health was poor. I didn't know quite where he was, and he was surrounded so much, you know. Just the con line had gone to the old man, and I didn't want it to go to some half-crazed secretary who wouldn't know its importance and wouldn't be able to evaluate it properly. And so I didn't bother. I just couldn't get it to him. There was no way I could get it to him, so I just had to leave it and hope that it would come right for him in the end. But anyway, back to the unstacking procedure. First off, I'd better clarify why postulates and intentions, goals and purposes, I regard as the same breed of cat and all synonymous with each other. It comes from where the word postulate comes from in English language. The word postulate comes from the old Latin postulare, to demand. And the idea of demand is the very essence of a postulate. When we postulate something, we're demanding that something is going to happen. When we make the postulate to know, we want to know. You know, there's something we want to, we're demanding something. Demanding to know, you see, the must know. So the word is correct there. You know, when I say that a postulate is the same as a purpose, is the same as an intention, I'm on very, very firm ground in the English language, because that is where the word means that. It comes from the word Latin to demand, the word postulate. so that my usage is correct. In his glossary, I'll just look his glossary up, hang on. Interestingly enough, Greg, you can always tell how much a person knows about the mind or some aspect of the mind by looking in their glossary of terms. You know, if they've got offbeat definitions of phrases and offbeat definitions of words, you know they've got some hang-ups on that subject. It's quite interesting. They go straight to the glossary. Quite revealing. Searching through, looking for what his definition of apostolate. I know it's slightly offbeat for mine, but I can't find it. So I'll have to abandon it, but I can assure you, Greg, that mine is more in line with the dictionary definition of apostolate. If you look it up in the dictionary, you'll find that it's essentially a purpose or an intention. It's used in science, the word apostolate. When a scientist has got to make a computer model, he has certain postulates he feeds into his model, and they're his basic postulates. He calls those postulates rather than the intentions. The basic postulate structure we're using on this model, and people know what he means. But essentially, the postulates he's putting in are purposes. They're essentially purposes. I think I better clarify that once and for all. Let's take this word significance. Now, he has a different idea of significance than I do. He defines significance. Significance, the conceptual and factual content of an experience, such as the ideas encountered in study as opposed to the phenomenal content, such as pictures or objects, etc. He goes on for another sentence. Now, this is a complicated understanding of significance. The significance of a thing is simply the purpose plus its importance. That is the totality of significance. There isn't anything else to do with significance except purpose and importance. When we say significance, we say, what does a thing signify? What does it mean? The word significant comes from the word, same root as the word signal. What are the signals it's sending us? What does it mean? So if we know what it means, and we know what its significance is, but its meaning is essentially its purpose, its function. That is its essential meaning. So we're down to the function again. So significance is purpose plus the importance. That's all. A thing may have many purposes, and each purpose may have an importance. But essentially, when you take significance apart, you're taking apart postulates. You're taking apart intentions, purposes, and that's all. There's nothing else there. He gives the example of motherhood as a significant. Yes, motherhood is a significant. But what is motherhood? Well, motherhood is the state of being a mother. And what is being a mother? Well, the identity of being a mother is the identity of a person who's operating on the goal to mother, the purpose to mother. We say that a person, when they're operating on that goal to mother, they are a mother. You see that? So when we examine this concept, this significance of motherhood, we take it down. We see that it's to do with mothers, and mothers are to do with the goal to mother, the postulate to mother. You see, so we're back to purposes again. You see, so significance is essentially it's a purpose. A significance is a purpose plus an importance, and that's all it is. That's all the significance is. You can take any significance and reduce it down to a purpose plus an importance. So he hasn't got a really good grasp of significance there. He hasn't got a good understanding of significance. Now, this isingness he sticks on as a suffix at the end. I've read that bit over and over again, and I don't see why he's doing this. And it seems to introduce a false note into his material. I've gone around kicking plenty of cats in my life, but I've yet to engage in kick-isingness of cat-isingnesses. Kick-isingnesses of cat-isingnesses. I just don't do it. I kick cats. I'm sorry. This sticking isingnesses on the end has got nothing to do with life, as far as I'm concerned. It may have a lot to do with Mr. Nichols's bank, but it's got nothing to do with life. And I'm only really concerned with the factors that exist in life. I just don't see this icing. This I don't see where it all comes in. It's an added complexity which doesn't seem to do anything except make it more complicated. And Ockham, William of Ockham, with his razor, which said that never add hypotheses unnecessarily. I'm a great believer. He was a great friend of mine. Ockham was. And, I don't believe in adding hypotheses unnecessarily in order to make a thing just for the sake of making the thing more complicated. Maybe I'm doing the man a misjustice, an injustice. Maybe there is a good reason why he had to use this strange suffix on the end of all his goals. But I've reread it, and I just cannot find out where he says why you have to do this, and why it won't work if you don't do it. So I just assume that it's some peculiarity of him, or some peculiarity he's got from someone else, and he's got himself stuck with. But certainly, icing this is not something that I stick on at the end of my goals. And people don't go around and talk about icing this. They don't say, well, I had a good day. I had a good day of eating ice creaming. This is, you know, or eating this is of ice creaming. This is, they say, I ate an ice cream. You know, I'm sorry, Greg. I've got a very simple mind. You know, I hate unnecessary complexity. If I'm going to avoid it, but. What we have in this procedure, essentially, he puts up this dichotomy, he gets the goal, and he asks the pre-clear for the opposition to the goal, flunk. You shouldn't do that. That's one thing you mustn't do, because he'll only give you a wrong oppose. Every example he gives there has got a wrong oppose. They're either wrong opposes or they're cross-packaging. Now, that's the other mistake. I mean, that's a gross error, that is, a cross-package, you know. So the wrong oppose is bad enough, but the cross-package is absolutely, you know, I mean, it's completely inexcusable. The cross-package is to take a goal out of one goal package and oppose it to a goal which is out of another goals package. It's like putting the goal to no and opposing it to the goal to not sleep. You know, that's cross-packaging. So that they're opposed to each other. The goal to know and the goal to not sleep are opposed to each other. Well, that's cross-packaging. It's a wrong oppose, but it's also a cross-packaging. So it's an even bigger flunk, an even more severe wrong oppose. Because it's not even in the same area. It's in another subject. So anyway, he somehow gets the goal and he gets the wrong oppose, and then he has to spend hours and hours, as you would expect, using all sorts of Scientology techniques. The old surfact technique comes into action. He gets all sorts of techniques coming into action, trying to discharge this, get this dichotomy, which is just two wrong opposes in opposition. They simply won't discharge at all. There's no reason why they should. They've got nothing really to do with each other, you know. They're just wrong opposes. They'll just sit there forever. And so he tries to get them to discharge. So he has to work for hours and hours and hours asking these various questions and so forth, and ransacking the past. He's bending over backwards to try and make these damn things erase. They won't erase because they're wrong opposes. Ron was doing exactly the same thing. He was using all sorts of techniques to try and get these wrong opposes to discharge. They wouldn't discharge because they were wrong opposes. But they, you know, they were simply the incorrect oppositions, and so they would just sit there. And that's what this guy's doing too, you know. Now, what do I think is the overall effect of doing the procedure of the unstacking? Well, if it was done in very, very careful hands, it might take 50 hours before the tone arm will go up to 5 and stick. But eventually that will be the end point. That's where it would go. And that's what I don't think it would, I don't think you'd get much else out of it. Oh, you know, running up and down and asking for instance, that might be good, but you might get some benefit out of that, asking for instance. Pre-clear will get a bit of gain out of erasing a few incidents or reducing a few incidents. But the overall effect of this wrong oppose, well, I think, would swamp out any benefits you'd get. And I think the overall tendency would be for the case to tighten up more and more, and for more and more mass to appear, and the tone arm to to relentlessly rise and eventually stick. And it would need a repair. He'd have to run level 5A to get it, my level 5A to get free gear back to where he was again, or get to repair it. Now, the other aspect that I noticed about it, you noticed this in your summary of it, was you said that it seems to run all right, but it seems to run over that way. Well, yes, it does. It's all over that way, the technique is. The person is the observer, and he's sitting watching this bank, which is over that way. Well, my experience of erasing prostate pre-clears, they have to get into the prostates and get their paws dirty. They have to get in there and own the prostate and get the feel of the prostate and get into the prostate. They won't erase otherwise. You can't just put it all over that way and sit and watch it erase, you know, like you're watching a TV set. Nothing happens. You spotted this yourself. You said that the efforting, there's not much efforting in it. It doesn't seem to do much. No, it wouldn't do, because it's all over that way. So the whole thing will become a rather intellectual exercise. It's all over that way. So that's my other criticism of it there. Yes, when I'm asked to evaluate it, it will be this material. It's like being asked to evaluate some of Hubbard's material on goals and postulates and purposes back in the 1960s, because the material is so similar. I would lay a bet that this guy was on the briefing course from 1961 to 64. I'd lay a bet, and that he's been sitting holding this mass, this engram he collected between 1961 and 1964, and sometime along the line he's got in there and trying to use what he knows, and he's modified it. And reckon he got some benefit out of this procedure, and he's gone ahead and published his procedure and called it unstacking. But essentially, I would lay a bet that Nichols is, although the name doesn't ring a bell with me, I'd lay a bet that he's got caught on this procedure, either directly at St. Hill, or somebody's run it on him, and he's got stuck with a major engram on his own track. This material has become a major engram on the track. And he's trying desperately to take it apart. You see, things never give up. You're sticking with something. All these characters at St. Hill between 1961 and 1964 who got stuck with this material of bronze, this gold material, you know, they've all been trying to figure it. You know, most of them are probably still figuring it out today. They never give up. They never give up trying to solve it. I never gave up when I solved it. It took me, I got 1978 before I got it apart, got it solved. I never gave up. And I don't think any of the others gave up. They don't give up. People don't give up on this one. They get this, you lay a major engram in, and they'll work at it until they get it resolved. And I think that's what Nichols has done. He's tried to get it resolved. Maybe he had a bit of early success with this idea, but I don't think it would do anything eventually, but end up. It can't do, Greg. It can't go anywhere but into wrong oppose and cross packaging, and the end point of wrong oppose and cross packaging is a high tone arm and a stack needle and a black field and the winds of space, and eventually they lower the coffin lid on you gently and take you off to the cemetery and say rest in peace. That's the only end point. You know, you, as I said earlier on the tape there, when you play around with postulates in opposition, you've got to get it right. You've got no leeway whatsoever. No leeway whatsoever. You either get it right or you kill the pre-clear. It's an awful, awful thing, but there it is. That's why my injunction there on my own research material not to hand it out to mentally unstable people, because they simply cannot duplicate it, and they won't do it right, they'll do it wrong, and it don't only need the slightest alteration of alterousness for the technique of level 5A, and my level 5A becomes a time bomb. You know, I mean, I know more ways to louse up free clears. You've only got to slightly alter his 5A. That becomes a very, very dangerous procedure that will eventually kill everyone that it's tried on, and it louses them up. That's why my injunction that it must be duplicated exactly, and it mustn't be handed out to unstable, mentally unstable people who can't use it properly. So much for the unstacking procedure, Greg. I can't think of any more on the subject. I think I've covered it pretty well now. Just finish off what we've got, a little bit of tape here. Since I gave you my research data, I can tell you now there's no more than about 30 erasable gold packages in total, about 25 to 30. And the major ones you do have there, I did discover some others that are erasable, which can be tacked onto the list if you want to tack them on. Probably the most important one is the Gold to Reason. It has the Gold to Reason, to Not Reason, to Be Reasoned, to Not to Be Reasoned. There are the four legs of the Gold to Reason. It's a very, very good gold. It takes apart the subject of logic and the bricklayer's mind and squares him around on the subject of logic. For persons having trouble on the subject of reason and logic and so forth, that would be the precise goal to run on him, the goal to reason. And it should be, it's a specific for people who have trouble reasoning. So it's a valuable goal. So you can add the goal to reason there into the set. But there's only about 25 or 30 erasable goals that can be formulated into erasable goals packages. All the other verbs in the English language cannot be formulated into erasable goals packages. So it tells you how limited we are. The granddaddy of all the erasable goals is the goal to know. That's the key one. The other thing I'd like to say, Greg, is that when anyone who does my research will discover an enormous amount of material about the human mind and the life and the universe and so forth, and the humans and the psyche and so forth, and the laws that govern the universe while they're doing the research. If they care to write these things down and so forth, I mean, I've got stacks of notes and so forth, the stuff that came up when I was running this material there, but it's not really relevant to hand it over to people, because it's quite unreal to them. But when they run the material themselves, it will become real to them, and they will rediscover it. So I don't have to tell it to them. They'll discover it for themselves. They'll come up and say, oh, yes, you know, the so-and-so and so-and-so. And I'll say, oh, yes, yeah, we know about that. And it will pop up. In other words, they'll discover it themselves when they're running level 5 of my material. Yeah. So there's much more of my material than what I've given you. I've given you what you need to run the material, to run and erase the mind, and the rest of it comes out in the wash. You will discover the rest while you're using the material I've given you. So I don't have to really give you any more. Any more would be a luxury. And it can be very confusing. And I don't want to overburden anyone with it. Because until a person gets to work on it and starts to work with the material, some of this upper level stuff can get quite unreal. That's why I didn't go on and give you the material, more material on the anatomy of sensation, the anatomy of mass in the universe. I've got more data on it, but it's so wild and woolly that and I simply can't prove it anyway at this stage, and so I'm simply not going to go into it. I won't be drawn on the subject of it. So that's That is another aspect there, Greg, that's worth bearing in mind. It all comes out in the wash. I think I mentioned it in the research there. I said that erasing a goals package is like doing a university course on that subject of the goals package. It's the equivalent of doing a university course. You become an absolute expert on the subject of that goals package. You really know about it after you've erased the goals package, no matter what the goal is. Supposing you wanted to become an expert on the subject of help. Well, if you want to really know about the subject of helping and what help's all about, therefore, well, just sit down and erase the To Help Goals package. It's quite erasable. And by golly, you'll know about help. And you'll be able to spot help in society, and you'll be able to spot no help. And our help gets aberrated. You'll know all about help. And you can look back at what wrong wrote, and she says, yep, we're on, but the old man was quite right, he got it right, he knew about it, he got it all out. And similarly, we learn the other goals package. It's very educational, it's not only therapeutic, it's highly educational to run a goal, erase a goals package. Going back for a moment to the subject of the anatomy of the mass in the universe, a person doesn't really have to know this anatomy, you know. One can walk one came into the universe without knowing the anatomy of it, and one can walk out of this universe without knowing the anatomy of it. You don't have to know the exact anatomy of the walls and tables and floors and so forth of the universe, this universe, before you can get out of this universe. Really, it's sufficient to know that they consist of postulates, that they consist of a postulate configuration, a scrunched up postulate configuration, and really that's sufficient to, that's really all you need to have to know. And of course you have to know about the goals packages and so forth, and erase them and get rid of the mind and so forth, and then you start thinking about walking out of the universe. Well, that's about wraps it up, Greg. I can't think of much else to get on to. It's coming towards the end of the tape anyway. I don't want to get into anything else before the tape and have the tape run out on me. If you're still in touch with Bill Nichols, the guy who developed the unstacking procedure, you could, it's quite okay with me if you want to send him a copy of my material. He might be very interested in it. In fact, you might save his life. His tone arm should be getting up pretty high by now, if he's still working on it, if he's still working on his unstacking procedure. He should be using a Mark 14 meter by now, which has super sensitivity, and he should be looking for little drops of tone arm between 6.9 and 6.85 on his meter. You know, he should be getting pretty high, that tone arm, by now. I'm only joking. I hope it's not that bad. But anyway, you certainly have my permission to ship him off a copy of my data. Also, I certainly have no objection if you make a nominal charge to people of, for your duplicating costs of this material when you send it off to them. That's something entirely up to you. So I certainly have no objection, as long as you make it quite clear that it's you that's charging and it's not me that's charging it. They're your charges and not my charges. I leave it entirely to your discretion, your good sense, as to who you send the material to. I'm sure you're quite aware of the limitations as well as I am, so I leave it entirely up to your good sense. Okay, Greg, well, that's about it. I hope to hear from you soon. And if I can send you some more data or anything else to clarify, I'll be pleased to do so. I don't mind if you communicate with me by tape or whether you communicate with me by letter. I see that on the letter you wrote, it's a nice big print. With my bad eyesight, if you do write a letter, make the print nice and large, or if you've got a tape recording facility, then by all means record a tape. I can play back tapes here quite comfortably, so I'm quite happy to converse with you by tape. Recording a tape is far, far easier for me than writing. Writing is very, very difficult for me these days because of my bad eyesight. Even a typewriter is getting beyond me, so that's why this material is on a tape rather than written. It's much easier for me to record with a microphone than it is to write or use a typewriter. Well, that's about it at the moment, Greg. So I'll say ta-da to you, and all the best. And again, thank you for duplicating my material. And bye for now. Bye bye.